Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some of the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute who are doing amazing things in preparation for the open house that's going on over there on Thursday. Right now, I'd like to welcome Sheila Ortego. She is the author of The Road from La Cueva, published by Sunstone Press. She also happens to be president of Santa Fe Community College. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, who knew that you were also a fiction writer?
Probably no one. I think I've been a closet writer for a long time.
Really?
Yeah. It took me 15 years to write the book. One of the big questions I get is, how did you write a book being a college president? And the answer is, I didn't. I finished it before I became president, and since then I've just been trying to fine-tune it and sell it.
And so this is a book, it's actually a great picture of an absolutely horrendous marriage.
That's true.
You wrote it over a period of 15 years. That's a long time to be working with that material.
Well, I think if you do the math, it just doesn't add up. But the real deal is that I was working two jobs for many years and just fit in writing on the book, you know, sporadically.
But, I mean, as author, your sort of feelings and emotional development are going to change on such an emotional subject, I would think.
Well, I really think I didn't struggle with any of that. I think, you know, since part of it was based on experience that I had in my life, I had to get separated from it anyway. So I think as more years went by, the book got better and more objective. I was able to see the characters more clearly and be fair to them.
So emotion recollected in tranquility.
Yes.
So what was the motivation? In other words, as a writer, you wanted to tell a story of a woman struggling to basically get out of a situation in which she's really not happy, and then all the barriers that seem to be more inner than outer that are in her way.
That's true, and that's what I was trying to convey, is how people sort of imprison themselves in their own fears and reluctance to act and get out of bad situations.
And there's always this question of, is she safe enough to go?
Right, and I think that's, I was trying to make folks sympathetic with her character in that, you know, some folks read it and really do get it, that even though there isn't something very concrete and definite that her life is in danger, I think it's conveyed that she, in her mind, she is in danger and she's in jeopardy and it's unknown. And so she struggles with that. In the end, people sometimes wonder why there are no fireworks when she leaves, but that's part of the point, is she has really just restricted herself for many years when she really could have acted and had a happier life.
Now, this dude whom she is married to, whose name is Frank, when they were dating, sets out some rules for her, and one of the rules is put your family first, and one of the rules is you may have no friends, and another rule is you have to follow any rules as I come up with them. Now, this woman is not stupid. She works in a hospital. She's a nurse or social worker, and she agrees to that.
That's another comment I get about the book, is some folks say this isn't a new subject, or maybe this isn't so true anymore. It might have been true in the 70s, but as I talk to many women about the book, I find that this theme is as relevant as ever. That patriarchal system, that acceptance of women to be in a submissive role or to be dominated, is deeply ingrained in our society and hasn't been eradicated at all. It's very psychological, very difficult for women to get out of. So I think it's very common still.
And I think it's also interesting, and it sort of makes one reflect on what are the unspoken rules. I mean, in this case, they're laid out, which is sort of amazing, but in many relationships, whether they be friendships or love relationships or parents and children or whatever, there's all sorts of unspoken rules that get solidified, and then you really feel that you can never break them.
Well, you hear that's what goes wrong with a lot of marriages, is if things are going along fine while you're dating, and then when you get married, both parties have a lot of unwritten rules and expectations, and then they start sort of creeping out, and you find out about them, and then it's difficult to deal with them. And because of Frank's personality in the book, it was hard for Anna to confront that and talk about it and say, you know, just don't treat me that way.
One wonders what his redeeming qualities ever were.
I tried to convey that he was a good father, that he loved both his daughter and his wife, but he really didn't know how to love in a real way. So that's another part of the theme is, in the lover, Michael, someone who is able to love someone for who they are and give them the freedom to be themselves and go into a love relationship without fear.
And so, of course, there is this other love interest that she meets on the job, and she has to sneak around because her husband seems to be almost psychic about, you know, when even if her eyes look different or something.
Well, he's constantly vigilant. I think he is a man who's filled with fear and insecurity. And I'm not sure if I did such a great job of making him a sympathetic character, but on some level I wanted to. I think he was a victim of his own background. At some point I tried to convey that he had been hurt in his family relationship, that his mother had left his father for another man, and so that's how he viewed the whole world as a place that he couldn't trust. So certainly if he'd had a different personality, I think Anna might have had more compassion for him, but he translated that into sort of a very dictatorial, surveying style that really became very difficult for her to deal with.
You tread lightly around any connection between people's personalities and the cultures from which they come.
That's a good question. When I think about the various cultures, I think I was trying to convey with Margaret, who was a Mescalero Apache, how beautiful her culture was. And even though some readers who might look at the book on a shallow level and say, well, she lived in a trailer, it wasn't that clean, there were dogs and cats everywhere, she lived this sort of messy, unorganized life. Really what I was trying to do was to get above that level to more spiritual level and show that Margaret was really the most special person in the book in terms of her maturity and her development and her wisdom and spirituality.
And she's very sympathetic, and she takes care of the main character, Anna's daughter, when
right.
She's in a pinch, especially when she's going out to have her little illicit liaison with her friend from work.
Yeah. I mean, another issue on the cultural level is Anna was living this life and went down to the laundromat at one point in this village that she lived nearby and was doing the laundry and observing the Hispanic women of the village and sort of envying their lives that were built around simple principles, growing their own food and doing the laundry and socializing with one another. And because she was so isolated, I was trying to convey the difference in the culture between Anglo society, where we sort of separate out from our families and are isolated, and Hispanic culture, which really has families together and a community that's still intact.
And then the ladies in the laundromat yell at her for having a naughty daughter.
I didn't mean to convey that they were yelling at her, but they were kind of shocked at the behavior of the child, and that I did try to convey that there was a quite precocious child in this situation and very different from the children of that other culture.
Now, the other issue of safety that Anna, the character, the heroine, has is even with her own mother, who, you know, when she's having trouble in her marriage and goes to her mother, she gets a sermon instead of sympathy.
Right. That was another theme I was going for in the book, is it's sort of grief for a parent that's lost and reconciliation with a parent that has been a difficult relationship. And I try to draw that out over the course of the book, how Anna's mother is not very understanding or supportive, but eventually shows that, you know, when the rubber meets the road, she cares about her daughter and they come to some sort of peace with each other.
And the contrast between the two parents is symbolized by the music that each of them listens to and raises their daughter with.
Right. The father, who's passed away, is into the blues and sort of earthy music from the South, emotional, sensual music. The mother is very much embroiled in a restrictive religion that somewhat parallels the life that Anna lives with Frank, and it's very suppressive.
We're talking to Sheila Ortego. The book is called The Road from La Cueva, published by Sunstone Press. And there's also, I mean, the, some of the fun of reading the book, living here in New Mexico, is it's just full of the details of this particular area.
Right. One thing I had a lot of fun with was writing about the road, which I think
that's what I was thinking. The road.
Yeah, almost a metaphor for life, because you can really get stuck in life. You might have to dig out. You might have to go over some rocky roads, and then, you know, when the road is clear, you've got the exhilaration of a fast, straight ride. So Anna's struggle throughout the book in her marriage is kind of paralleled by her struggle with the road.
And the sort of endless pleading to get the holes in the dirt road fixed. I mean, the book opens with her driving into a ditch because the road is so bad.
Well, that's actually all based on reality. A lot of people ask me, you know, what's real and what isn't real, and all I can say is a lot isn't real, but a lot is real. You take, when you're writing fiction, you draw from your own experience and people that you know, but it all gets kind of jumbled up, so there's some element of truth. And sometimes it's just literal, and in the case of the road, it was literal. It's it was a very bad road at the time, full of caliche, and you could really just get your half of your car enmeshed in this road. But now you go up and look at the road. It's up in the mountains in New Mexico, and all of the mud is washed away, and it's just pure rock now. But a lot of people read it and say, God, I've lived on a road like that. I know what that's like.
So this is, it's interesting to me that you decided at this point to publish this book. You're the president of Santa Fe Community College. I'm sure a lot of your colleagues and maybe some of the students in the college will read this, and here you are, a public personage. Does it feel, I mean, how do you work with whatever? I mean, I'm sure people are saying, oh my goodness, this must be autobiographical. She's, you know.
Well, I've really tried to keep those roles separate, because as the president of the community college, you want to set a good role model for everyone, and there are certain values expressed in the book, but I think the values expressed in the book, if people do get confused between the role of me as a president and me as an author, I feel fine about them. I think what the book stands for is truth and spirituality and individual growth and coming to an actualized happy life, which is what I think everyone needs to do.
So it does bring up the larger question of where are women at this point, even in the 15 years since you started writing this, or more, whenever you started this book. I mean, have we made, I know we've made progress since the time before there were, for example, rape crisis centers and domestic violence shelters and so on.
Well, just the fact that rape crisis centers and battered women's shelters are alive and healthy today is testament to the fact that we still have a problem. The fact is they now have help to go to. But, you know, we have Girls, Inc. in Santa Fe to train young women to be strong, smart, and bold. And every day they struggle with young women who they see in relationships like this. And they're 15 years old, and they're getting ready to go into a lifetime of it. And these are the folks who go to the Rape Crisis Center in Esperanza. And this situation is still all around us. I did another interview, and when I finished, I came out, and someone said, oh, my God, so-and-so's daughter needs to read this book because she's right in this situation. I think every woman you talk to at least knows of someone who's living like this.
What do you think keeps it in place?
The dysfunction of men dominating women and being abusive. I would have to say, you know, 5,000 years of the patriarchy. As one of my friends likes to say, it's just deeply ingrained in our culture. We don't, we're not a matriarchal society. We're still patriarchal. And, you know, witness what goes on with the elections and the comments about, you know, the sort of differentiation between female candidates and male candidates.
Do you have a particular female candidate in mind?
Well, you know, it is difficult whether you're in college administration or whether you're in a presidency or political life, there is a different value judgment on women who act in a certain way, who try to be strong and authoritative. There is a lot of judgment and sort of unconscious judgment about how women should and shouldn't act, I believe.
Does that, I mean, again, now, let's not go anywhere you don't want to go, but does that, do you have to deal with that as president of a college?
You know, I have a great team, and I'm really enjoying my role at the college. So I would say in my career, in over the years that I built my career, I absolutely had to deal with that. I had many, many interviews with men over the years where they said, well, how are you going to cook dinner for your husband, you know, if you're working on a night shift, or, well, we're just not sure you can handle the job if you've just had a baby. We know how much work, you know, having babies are. One guy told me, well, you know, we don't like to hire young women of childbearing age because they tend to leave and have children. And I said, well, I don't intend to have children for many years, so it shouldn't be a problem. And he said, why not? My wife and I have two children, and we think they're lovely. And I thought, well, I just can't win with this guy. And
oh,
that wasn't
goodness.
That many years ago. And I think, you know, people have become more aware of the laws that prevent you from saying things like that now. But I think the thoughts still enter people's heads.
So there are laws that prevent you from saying things like that now. Are they followed?
I think for people who are savvy, they are, but I would take a look at lawsuits and complaints, and you would probably see that it still goes on. Certainly, I hear lots of sexual harassment stories from all sorts of agencies that still goes on. People may or may not be aware that it's inappropriate, but they do it anyway.
In the 70s, there were consciousness-raising groups. In the 80s, there were support groups. How are women talking to each other and dealing with this stuff now?
Well, I live in this little world of the community college, so I immediately think of our wonderful Women in Transition program, where women are coming in because they are in a difficult relationship, have just gotten out of one, are trying to sort out their lives or become independent, and we help them in many ways in that program. And I would say those programs that we've talked about before are just incredible support systems, but those are almost set up for crisis. So I think the point you're making is, where do women go if they're not particularly in crisis? And I would say we have a lack of resources. I was a big proponent of women's studies programs and showing women that they have a history, that they have a literature, that they have a great, unique qualities that need to be celebrated and built upon, and I don't think we have the resources we had in the 70s.
Are there, for example, women's studies classes at the community college?
There are occasionally, but the whole field of ethnic studies and women's studies, Southwest studies, those things have kind of dried up over the years, and as I sort of waited for a resurgence in the youth's political interest in the country and the direction it was going, which I think is now coming around, I'm sort of also looking for a renewed interest in this sort of cultural pride of minority groups, of women, and I think that will come around again.
It's interesting because sometimes you talk to young women and they say, oh, we don't need that stuff anymore.
Well, I am so happy to hear that, when young women don't need that anymore. And I think often they're telling the truth. I think many women have made gains. If you study at all third world countries, though, you see that that is happening all over the place. They haven't made any gains at all. And we're getting folks in America from third world countries, and they bring those husbands and those traditions and those problems with them. So if nothing else, we still have a worldwide problem to deal with.
We're talking to Sheila Ortego. She is the author of The Road from La Cueva, published by Sunstone Press, and president of Santa Fe Community College. Let's talk about Sunstone Press. This is one of Santa Fe's own local presses.
Well, I just thanks for the opportunity to say thanks to Jim Smith and Carl Condon of Sunstone Press. They've been wonderful. I hear wonderful things about their publishing company all of the time, and people are just impressed with the book, hearing about Sunstone Press, so that's a nice plus. And also I appreciate the fact that they referred me to Melissa Weiner, my publicist, who's just done a wonderful job for me.
So what next? Are you going to keep writing fiction?
I've actually started on the next book.
Really?
It's very difficult to find an agent. They're sort of in hiding out there, and you have to just get lucky and find someone who knows of an agent or be in that network or live in New York or California, which I don't. But someone was kind enough to introduce me to an agent the other day who works with a firm in New York, and I'm about to meet with him and give him the outline of my next book, which is on my Acadian family history.
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I have always been fascinated with that history. Acadian morphed to the word Cajun. What happened was in Nova Scotia in 1755, about 7,000 Acadians were deported. It was the first ethnic cleansing of North America, really. They were put on ships and sent to the colonies and off to Europe. And they eventually made their way down to Louisiana and started a new life down there and became called Cajuns. And that's my heritage, and I've always been fascinated with that terrible period.
Are you from
period.
Louisiana?
Yes. I was born in New Orleans, which I now call Atlantis.
All right. So that is something that in your abundant spare time you'll be...
Actually, it is really a struggle. So on weekends, any time I have a day off or I'm on a long plane ride, I work on it. But I do know I plan it to be a historical fiction, and it's going to have to be a long, complex book. And I keep joking that if I can live another 30 years, I might get it done.
Sheila Ortego, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The Road from La Cueva is published by Sunstone Press and is available in our local bookstore.
It should be at Borders, and it's also on Amazon.com.
And she's president of Santa Fe Community College, which I hope we will get a chance to talk about another day here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking to the residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Please stay tuned. And I would like now to welcome Sarah Sutton. She is a painter, and she is one of the residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is holding its open studio this Thursday, the 22nd of May, at 5:30. It's free, and there's free refreshments and lots of fun. Now, Sarah Sutton, welcome, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you.
You were a philosophy major. You studied film, and then now you're a painter. Can you talk about that trajectory
for you? I actually went to John Carroll University, studied philosophy, and I was starting to do film and film theory at that time. Moved to California to go to film school, and completely 360'd. Once I got to L.A., I decided that film was not what I wanted to do, and I started painting in my spare time, and then working at MoCA L.A., and then...
MoCA, you know, is being a museum.
Yes, Museum of Contemporary Art. And just completely switched what I was doing. To me, the painting was much more tactile. I didn't feel that I needed the narrative component of film. My work was very abstract in film anyway, so I completely switched to painting.
And so you have a kind of interesting process in painting where you make collages, and then sometimes you scan them, and then you paint from those collages. So it's a lot of levels of remove from anything that you might call reality.
Yes, I call it kind of a hybrid process. I do these multiple layers of information. The paint is applied in about five different ways. The collage is kind of left over from my film background. I've always collected scrapbooks and kind of juxtaposed images, similar to editing. So it becomes this process where I kind of work the images into the painting. They become very much abstracted because I repeat them over and over.
And so what kind of imagery do you start with, and is that even important?
Well, I always start with imagery from pop culture. I'm very interested in just kind of snippets of everyday life, usually feminine imagery, things that have traditionally represented empowerment, but that I kind of call into question, things like Madonna's bullet bra, kind of commodified feminism, so to speak.
Yeah, commodified feminism. What do you mean by that?
The idea that it's kind of marketed that you can buy these symbols of power, and that by wearing them or buying them, that you can participate in a form of empowerment. And so I kind of question that in my work.
And so you work on Mylar, which is this sort of film-like substance that isn't really paper.
Right. It's a polyester film, so it's completely synthetic, and it's translucent, so you can really see through the back. And I work on the front and the back, which allows me to really layer.
And so, and all of this is the way, I mean, it's a little hard sometimes to talk about visual images on the radio, because even if you hold them up to the microphone, it doesn't work. But everybody can come to the open studios at the Santa Fe Art Institute on Thursday at 5:30 in the afternoon. Now, when we were talking yesterday, we were talking about this phenomenon, and I don't know how new it is that people tend to, in a media-saturated culture, really focus on the visual more than the other senses.
Mm-hmm. Kind of privileging the visual. Yeah, something else that I'm interested in, we had talked about the McGurk effect, where you see a video that's not synced with the audio, and if you're watching it with the sound, you hear what you're seeing. So you hear the sound that the mouth is performing, but it kind of cancels out your hearing.
Yeah, so if you watch that and you close your eyes,
yes.
Or if you open your eyes, you hear two different things.
Exactly.
Which is
and
very
even
strange.
In the middle of it, if you close your eyes, you start hearing what he's really saying, as opposed to watching it, you hear what you're seeing.
Now, is that, I mean, do you know if that's a phenomenon of a, you know, our media world, or is it?
I believe that's probably kind of a gestalt principle that was probably always there, but now we're learning more about it because of things like film.
So how did, when you are, you're a teacher, you're, I guess, a college professor.
Uh-huh.
When you are working with your students, and, of course, you're doing visual art, so sound and all these other things don't matter, but what are your students like? I mean, what are they focusing on?
Well, I've noticed that this younger generation, I'm in my 30s, so I guess I would be kind of Gen X, and they being Gen Y, so to speak, they tend to have a really good sense of design and not as good of a sensibility with drawing. And I've noticed that they really can play multiple images off of each other, layering. And I do believe that they've got such an influx of visual stimuli that doesn't really have a tactile or lived experience component, that they're really sophisticated at things like design and layering and things, but not so good at real-time observational drawing, which is very interesting to me.
Well, and I suppose a lot of them grew up with Photoshop more than
Absolutely.
With a pencil and paper.
Yeah, any kind of collage, editing, you know, assemblage, they seem to have a natural knack at.
And so how would you describe your work now? What would you like to invite people to see at the Art Institute?
Well, I would describe it as, it's on Mylar, which we already talked about. It's a very organic process. This series of work is called the Rhizome Series. I often start with inks. I work on the floor and kind of spray the inks and kind of let them do their own thing. They become very diaphanous. I use airbrush. It also kind of references street art or graffiti art in a way. I use a lot of stenciling. I also use acrylic paints, text. So I really mix hybrid processes to create these kind of pattern-based images that, you know, ultimately kind of are very colorful and fun, but very layered and lots of different messages. So.
Sarah Sutton, thanks so much for being with us. I'd like now to welcome Tatiana Simonova. She is an artist who is also at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you are from Bulgaria. How did you find yourself in the United States?
I was born and raised in Bulgaria, and I found my way to the United States in the year of 1999. I came through a cultural exchange student program and worked in Virginia for a few months. Did a cross-country road trip and found myself in San Francisco, where I became a student, got my BFA degree, and I moved on to New York, where I was a master's degree student at Pratt Institute.
Now, you have always been an artist, and your medium is drawing.
It is drawing. I actually started out as a landscape architecture major.
Is that right?
That's what I did in Bulgaria for 4 years, but moving on to a new country and a new environment, new experiences, kind of exposed my childhood desire to draw and to be creative.
And your drawings are incredible, and I wish you, there are some drawings that you've been doing at the Santa Fe Art Institute and many more that are on computer, and I was so sad that we couldn't see the real examples. But one of the bodies of work that you do is connecting to your family through drawing in Bulgaria.
Yes. I went back home after 6 years of life, permanent life in the United States, so it was quite displacement and middle ground to find myself back home, and I did a series of portraits and photographic images that was my attempt to connect with my family and put all of the family members that were in Bulgaria and were not any longer there in one environment and contain them. So the drawings are graphite on paper. They range from 60 to 60 to 60 by 170 inches.
Those are very big drawings.
Yep. I find that correlation between the scale of the drawing and the notions of that intimate memory that you hold in this in you to be what I'm interested in.
Now, so you're talking about really life-scale drawings of people.
They become almost life-size, and looking from far away, they can be the scale of a snapshot, and coming in closer, they become an abstract form that envelops you and contains you in it.
We're talking to Tatiana Simonova, and her work will be shown along with the other residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute on Thursday, this coming Thursday at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute in Santa Fe. Another thing that you draw is demolished buildings and mausoleums and all sorts of structures in Bulgaria.
Yeah, I found myself interested in that attempt to erase history. Much like erasure in drawing, history
right.
can never be completely taken away. It's always there to inform our present and our future. And I wanted to draw this demolished mausoleum in an attempt to have it be there forever, for the future generations to learn and for us to remember.
So this mausoleum, it was an attempt at an erasure of what, the communist period?
Yep. It was an attempt to erase the memory of an era that it had values that were no longer considered positive.
Now, let me ask you this. I don't know to what extent you want to talk about it, but the values of the communist era, the propaganda is that they're all negative and everybody's happy to be rid of them. Is that the experience of you and your family and the people around you?
I have to say it's not my experience. The political connotations of communism, I believe, vary from environment to environment and from family to family and people that you had around you. And my experiences I'm very fond of, and I find them amazing. And
what do you mean?
The communist regime fell in the year of 89, so I had spent around 11 years living in that environment, and I have very fond memories of a great community with no competition, with everybody being able to share their daily lives, their vacations, and more or less being equal, which is now non-existent. And what happens in a country that has lived under a certain regime and transferred to another is that the desire to be part of the new is so overwhelming that it becomes almost monstrous, unfortunately. It's like letting loose something that's been contained for so long. And I have fond memories of that era, and I believe that the values carry their positiveness.
We're talking to Tatiana Simonova, and her work is at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're going to turn now to Michael Sandoval, also a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Hi.
So you are a fiction writer and film director.
That's correct.
Based in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Originally Filipino?
Uh-huh.
So tell us about your work and what you're working on now.
I'm working on a novel. I started it 2 years ago. And I came here to Santa Fe to finish it, and hell or high water, I'm not leaving the city until it's done.
what's it about?
Without giving too much away, and without pretending too much that I know exactly what's going to happen in the end, it's a coming-of-age story of a young girl who discovers that she has certain powers. I will also say this, with a little asterisk at the end of my last sentence. It's a novel that, for me, is very much influenced by my interest in manga, Japanese anime, and also in the American Tall Tale. So for me, it's a bit of a cross-genre piece, a Western manga, if you will.
Now, when you talk about manga, are there drawings in it?
I hope so. But really, you can say it's a literary version of manga. It's a written version of manga. But for me, manga is about it's a kind of a tall tale too. I mean, for me, I've always been very interested in folklore and in mythology, and Japanese manga takes these elements and then gives them back to you times 10. gigantic creatures, literally gigantic creatures, creatures a 1,000 feet tall, you know, laser beams, and then you see this in this very magical way. And I'm a big fan of magic realism, and I'm a big fan of fantastical writing with quote-unquote adult literary fiction. Calvino is one of my favorite authors as well as Borges. And I think all this stuff comes in me and then gets mixed up, and then it comes out in this crazy writing.
And so the writing must be very visual and sort of action oriented.
It is, and you have to play a game between keeping it visual and taking care of your characters. But yes, it is, and also because I'm coming out of a film tradition. Though ironically enough, I started out with fiction. I got my MFA years ago from the University of Michigan, and then took a step aside and got into film for a good 10 years in New York. So there's this cross-filterization process. I'm very, very naturally visually person. I started out drawing and painting way back in college, but I was also writing, and film for me was a coming together of the two. Now I'm coming back to fiction writing, and inevitably I'm finding that, you know, here's a close-up, here's a wide shot.
Right.
But I'm trying not to be a slave to that.
So when you write a novel, when you write fiction, do you imagine it eventually being made into film?
Unfortunately, it's easy to be conditioned. For me to be conditioned like that, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. At the end, as a writer, I should be beholden to the spirit of the story and my character. With that said, yes, sometimes it slips in my mind, this could be made into a movie. But I try not to think of it too much because it can be distracting. I think ultimately I shouldn't be thinking about the marketability of the subject. I should think about telling my story.
So tell us more about this young woman with the special powers.
Ah, let's see. She's 13 years old. She's an orphan. The novel certainly plays with archetypes. Orphan, and gradually finds out that she has a connection to, we could say a supernatural element of the landscape, a connection to the nature, to spirits, to the trees, to the air, can see things that other people can't see. And this can be manifested in very physical things like literally seeing spirits, like literally making things, you know, float. What I love about this particular genre is you can take things that can be implied and you can see them. You know, I can have her see a pen that's floating, or I can have her float herself. And for me, that's fascinating. This is one of the things that I love about fiction, because I can do things in fiction that would cost me $100 million to do in film.
You can do it for free.
Exactly, with a pencil. And
right.
I can do it in 2 seconds, and it would take me 2 weeks to do in film.
That's hilarious. Well, also, when you're doing that kind of, I guess you would call it magical realism, you're working with, it's not real realism, but there's a set of rules so that within your story, those rules are consistent.
Yes, absolutely. I think that every work sets its own rules on the first page. And you have to be beholden to them, otherwise you begin to lie. So I have to always check myself. It's easy to be crazy and say, okay, I think I love pink elephants. I'm going to put a pink elephant on this page. But if it has no bearing on the landscape, then it doesn't belong there.
So is your character and her way of being in the world based on any particular set of folk tales or something like that?
I was taking a bit in the beginning from classic American tall tales, which for me is one of the main examples of American folklore or American magic realism. Pecos Bill, though the reality is Pecos Bill is very much a literary creation too, if you understand the evolution of this fictive Texan character who was able to lasso a tornado and ride it. Or, you know, put his wife on a horse and the wife was bucked all the way to the moon. But yes, I was definitely looking at this particular tradition, an American oral tradition of sitting around a campfire and just spinning these yarns where everything becomes larger than life. And some of these are also taken from friends I know who like to talk this way. I'm also looking a bit at some Native American traditions, mythological figures, and trying to be respectful all the way around and making these as specific as possible.
I have to say, when I was a little kid, I loved books in which magic things happened, in which time travel happened, and
sure.
objects that could take you into another dimension and so
yeah.
on. I always felt that those were reality, and the reality that I was living in was just so hopelessly stiff and material.
Yeah, I think that maybe the majority of people always wish that the mundane reality, that there was something else that was, you know, you open a door in the back of your room, and instead of you seeing a broom and a mop, you see another world. I think that there's this...
Yeah, and you look for that.
You look for that. I was a kid after reading the Narnia series.
Exactly.
And like a dorky 7-year-old, I began to open doors. I was like, okay, come on.
Yeah, this is the one
that's
going
to
have the trap door.
Absolutely.
Which, yeah. But you can do that. So you're going to be reading at the Open Studios on Thursday at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. You'll be reading from your...
Yes, I will. I will be reading an excerpt from my novel.
Michael Sandoval is a fiction writer and filmmaker. Maybe filmmakers on hold for the moment.
Temporarily. I'm going to go back to a feature film very soon.
Excellent. Thanks so much for being
Thank
here.
You for having me.
And I'd like now to welcome... Where's that? Nikki Nojima Lewis, and she is also a writer. And as we said when we talked yesterday, you've sort of done life in a different direction than many people have. You worked for a lifetime, retired, and then started doing fiction writing.
That's right. I'm going backwards by retiring and going back to school. I just got my PhD from Florida State University.
In creative writing.
Right.
It's the first time I'd heard of a creative writing PhD.
Well, there are more PhD programs now. When I started out 6 years ago, there were only a few at Houston, Mississippi, and Florida State.
So do you have to, in a scholarly way, read the complete works of everybody?
Oh, you bet. I had a 12-hour preliminary exam for my PhD, 4 hours every day, and my specialty was short story. And then you have the, you know, something similar to the Spanish Inquisition where you defend your dissertation. And there's your committee, you know, who are usually your friends and professors, but they're this...
But now they're coming at you
right,
with drawn swords.
Yeah, capacity.
So you grew up in a Japanese internment camp.
Yes. Pearl Harbor is my fourth birthday. And so I spent part of my childhood, almost 3 years of my childhood, in a desert camp in Minidoka, Idaho. But one of the reasons I'm here is because my father was in an enemy alien camp in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm kind of looking for, you know, what the desert will tell me. You know, in another month or so, I'll rent a car and travel out to some of those sites I'm told about and do some research and hope I get another story for my collection.
Was your family reunited after the war?
No. Part of my collection of short stories the third part of it is the diaspora that took place. The Japanese Americans who didn't go back to the West Coast then struck out for Des Moines, Iowa, or Chicago, Illinois, or even the East Coast. And I grew up in an all-white neighborhood and started a dance career at the age of 12. So I grew up in Chicago.
So did you talk to your father at any time in your life about what he'd experienced here in the Santa Fe area?
You know, that generation of men did not talk about that experience. I think it's similar to men who served in World War II and came home. And, I have a lot of people. I collect oral histories. People tell me that their dads never told them about that experience. That's changed a great deal since my generation and younger, where oral histories and there's just so much more information. I have an oral history play, in fact, on Japanese Americans called Breaking the Silence, and that's a main metaphor, I think, for many of us.
But your father's generation is pretty much gone.
They are gone, and that's why I'm here. And so whatever I find, I will have to partly create out of my imagination, out of my own memories and what I remember. But my dad never talked about this, but I was also very young and I wasn't interested in this phase of my history. There was a long period of denial for me, you know, and for many of my generation.
Now, in the piece that you're writing a fiction piece on the internment camps, as opposed to a lot of people have already written memoirs and so on. And in it, you talk about the things that happen, which are the same things that happen everywhere, like the, you know, infidelity and, you know, happiness. And it led to this interesting conversation which you and I had yesterday, which is that when you're part of a group that has not been treated well, do you write the dirty laundry, so to speak, which isn't really even dirty laundry, it's just normal, real life.
The human spectrum,
yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know, I feel there's much more tolerance now for that, because we don't have to defend ourselves, we don't have to present ourselves in a so-called positive way, and we can deal with our stories as human stories with the full spectrum of human behavior. So you get a group of people, you know, I mean, I talked about one of my models being the play Our Town, but this is our camp. So 10,000 people, you know, in a camp-like setting, living in barracks behind barbed wire. But nevertheless, there are families, there are children to discipline, there's loneliness, there's mental illness, there's all kinds of things going on. So these are basically people, ordinary people in extraordinary times.
Would you like to read a couple of minutes of your work?
Yes, thanks.
Nikki Najima Lewis.
I'll set this up a little bit. December 7th, 1937, Seattle, Washington. After hearing news of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Tomio Mori is driving to the public golf course, the only one he's allowed to play on. "Calm my nerves," he tells his wife. But he suddenly swings his car around and drives to the exclusive country club, which is now shut down for the season, where Tomio has been a barman for 15 years. Tomio pulls the DeSoto close to the wall, opens the trunk and locates his golf shoes, ties the laces together, and flings the shoes over the wall. He stands on the hood of his car, clambers onto its roof, and pulls up his golf bag. Rocking back, then forward, he heaves the bag over the wall, then leaps up the ledge, but loses his grip, his hands sliding helplessly, finally grabs fistfuls of vines and climbs, hand over hand, onto the ledge, then eases his body over the side. Dropping soundlessly to the ground, he picks up his bag and unbuckles the belt he's wound around it. In the fading light, on his hands and knees, he gropes for his shoes. One hangs by its laces from a hawthorn bush. Its mate lies in a bed of winter pansies. The best golf is played in a state of forgetfulness, concentration untouched by thought. He'd had days in which hundreds of hours of practice swings brought him to a state of pure breath and muscle memory, a state of superb play. He knows he'll probably have a few more such days, but can never predict when. Hitting a small ball with a long stick alone on a darkening day, off season and on forbidden ground, appeals to his sense of the absurd. He loves the long strides down the fairway after he's hit the ball. He loves the way the white flag that marks the hole flutters in the breeze. Most of all, he loves the calm that sweeps over him as he stands on the green to angle a putt. To him, the rules of the game are the rules of civility. Step to the tee carrying at least two balls in your pocket. If you need to hit a second ball, it's bad manners to make others wait while you return to your bag. Have enough tees and know where your ball marker is. Care for your clubs. Brush and polish your golf shoes. Since early fall, a snarling slice has infected his game. He has no idea how he'll fare this day. He's losing the light. Snow flurries spin around him and he blows on his icy hands before he pulls the driver out of his bag. He slides one hand down the shaft and rubs the persimmon wood of the club head. He folds his fingers around the leather grip and places the club head on the ground. He positions his feet, taking a slightly open stance, relaxing his knees. He remembers Sam Snead's wiggle-waggle, and he loosens his hips, thinking of hula dancers. "Supinate," a voice comes like a whisper in the wind. "Turn the hand and forearm so the palm is upward." He supinates his left wrist, feeling coiled and poised behind the ball. "Brush, brush, don't think, brush the grass." He feels a calm he always works toward but has rarely known. Snow swirls around him, like fallen cherry blossoms.
And unfortunately, this is it's time to go. We're not done, but Nikki Nojima Lewis is a writer, and she will also be speaking at the Open Studios at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is this coming Thursday, the 22nd of May at 5:30. And for more information, you can call 424-5050, and they'll tell you how to get there and all that stuff. Free admission, free refreshments. Nikki Nojima Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and tomorrow the fabulous Jack Leffler is going to be here talking with us about his new book. So that and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista, baby. Ciao.